With that, we can proceed with arguments in People v. Nelson, case number 2012-CA-423.
Good morning. I'm Anthony Noble, registration number 33910, and I represent the appellant, Shauna Nelson. With me at counsel's table is Ruchi Kapoor, who's the co-author of the reply brief. The main issue in this case is whether trial counsel was laboring under a conflict of interest when he was representing Ms. Nelson at trial. And the context of this appeal is that it's a denial of a petition for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. To establish ineffective assistance of counsel as a result of a conflict of interest, the defendant must show that her attorney's representation conflicted with some other interest that the attorney had also professionally undertaken to serve. What we have to establish is that there was an actual conflict of interest. And an actual conflict of interest is being defined as one that is real and substantial and adversely affects counsel's performance. There are two examples of actual conflicts of interest that apply in this case.
Counsel, before we even get to whether there's a conflict, don't we have to determine whether or not the retrieval of this gun implicated legal advice, and you know whether Mr. Nelson had sought that advice?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that that's part of the analysis of whether or not it adversely affected counsel's performance.
So how does the fact that Mrs. Nelson asked her attorney to help retrieve the gun create an attorney-client relationship between the attorney and Mr. Nelson?
Well, that's what the district court speculated when denying this claim. The judge speculated that it was actually Ms. Nelson's request to retrieve this gun, and that he wasn't acting on behalf of Mr. Nelson when he was doing that. But I don't think that that really makes any sense, because the prosecution's theory here was that Ms. Nelson was the killer, that she either used her husband's gun or she used another gun, and she threw the shell casings from her husband's gun on the ground to kind of thwart the investigation. So if that was her motive or that was her plan, that she was trying to frame her husband by throwing his shell casings on the ground, then she would want her husband's gun to remain in police custody so that they would test it and they would draw this correlation between the shell casings and the gun, and therefore implicate him and move the focus away from her. So that was the district court's kind of speculation.
What is the test for establishing an attorney-client relationship?
Well, that's something that we've discussed quite thoroughly in the briefs.
What is that test?
Okay, well, first of all, that doesn't have to be a fee agreement. That doesn't have to be a retainer. There has to be this communication between the attorney and the person that he's setting out to serve, and that's what we have here is this, that we have the public defender who has been appointed to represent Ms. Nelson, but at the same time he's been approached by her husband to retrieve his service weapon.
Where in the record does that appear?
That appears in the, well, there are numerous places. You know, first, because this is a denial of a post-conviction claim without an evidentiary hearing, this court's review is a de novo review. And as part of the de novo review, you have to accept the allegations in the post-conviction motion as true. So the allegations that we have in the post-conviction motion are first that the PD sent an email to the district attorney on behalf of Mr. Nelson requesting the release of his service.
The PD sent the email to Mr. Nelson?
No, to the district attorney on behalf of Mr. Nelson.
How does that establish a relationship?
Because now he's representing Mr. Nelson in this issue of retrieving the service weapon.
How do you establish that?
Well, through the email for a start, in which, you know, the email actually says he's writing on behalf of Mr. Nelson that the service weapon, and there was another weapon as well, there was a rifle, that these have nothing to do with the case.
Is there anything in the record that Mr. Nelson contacted the PD?
Yes, Your Honor, there's Mr. Nelson. Yes, there is. First, there are the allegations in the petition for post-conviction relief that have to be accepted as true. The allegations are that there were several communications between Mr. Nelson and the PD. Then what happened is The police, for some reason, were monitoring the calls between, or at least they had records of telephone calls between Mr. Nelson and the PD, and this led to an investigation into what was happening because they wanted to know why he knew the serial numbers of the weapons that they had in custody. So a detective, I think it was Detective Prill, started looking into this relationship, and he noticed that there were these several calls between Mr. Nelson and the PD, because I think he must have been calling from his work number. But in addition to that, what the detective then did is he monitored the telephone records from the jail, and he listened to recordings between Ms. Nelson and the PD, in which she, sorry, not the PD, Ms. Nelson and Mr. Nelson, in which she was referring to the retrieval of the records, and he acknowledged that he was aware that the PD was going to file a motion for retrieval of those records.
Can an attorney assist in returning property to a witness without giving legal advice or anything of that nature? I'm trying to draw the line between when an attorney gives enough assistance or advice to be an attorney-client privilege as opposed to just some sort of incidental action that happens to benefit a third party.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there has to be, there would have to be some kind of legal advice, because if he's undertaken to retrieve these weapons from police custody on behalf of Mr. Nelson, then there must have been some kind of conversation in which he says, you know, they've got them, you know, I can do this or this to get the weapons back to you. And what he did do is we know that he did send the email. And then the other thing is that there was talk about him actually filing a motion for retrieval of those weapons as well. So,
right, but I guess what I'm saying is if the witness had asked the defense attorney, is there any way I can get my duty weapon back? And the attorney had said, well, let me look into that. I think I might be able to have him release it. Is that enough to be an attorney-client relationship?
I mean, it could be whenever an attorney gives advice to somebody, then there is that potential that it creates an attorney-client relationship. But I'm not really sure that we have to go to the extent of proving that there was an attorney-client relationship. I think that, you know, under the language in Castro, for instance, what we have to show is that the attorney had professionally undertaken to serve somebody else. And that's what happened here, is that it doesn't really make much sense that he was trying to do this on behalf of Ms. Nelson.
Why not? I mean, I could imagine a situation where an attorney would do something nice, like say, hey, listen, you know, you have property that belongs to a witness, why don't you return it? To get him to be friendlier when he's testifying for Mrs. Nelson. I mean, why can't we draw that inference, that it wasn't that she was giving him legal advice, but she was just being nice, hoping that her kindness would be returned?
Well, the problem with that is it creates a big difficulty for him. It puts him in the position where he could look unethical before the jury or before the judge. For instance, there are two reasons why he may be obtaining the weapons from police custody. One may be the reason that the judge gave, that he wanted to get the weapon out of police custody before it could be tested, so that there's no correlation between the casings at the scene and the weapon. But the problem with that is that, does an attorney really believe that he can get a weapon out of police custody that is the potential murder weapon before it could be tested? And then the second problem with that is, what happens if this information becomes available to the jury that he's trying to get this weapon out of police custody before it can be tested? The problem with that is it infers guilt on his client, that he knows that this is the murder weapon that his client has used, and therefore he's trying to get it out of the picture and create, you know, So by doing this, you know, it creates these ethical problems for him at the jury trial. And this is, it really comes to the second part of the test on the whether or not there's a conflict of interest. You know, did this adversely affect his representation of Ms. Nelson? And I think that if you look at the cross-examination of Mr. Nelson, you'll see that there's virtually no impeachment at all. He is very friendly. He's very approachable to Mr. Nelson. He's not challenging him on a key piece of evidence, which is the mask. If you remember the facts of this case, the killer wore a black Halloween mask and a black robe. And then when Ms. Nelson was stopped, a Halloween mask was found in her pickup truck. And during direct examination of Mr. Nelson, he was asked whether he'd ever seen that mask before, and he said no. And during the cross-examination, defense counsel asked him the same question. He asked him an open question when this was cross-examination, and Mr. Nelson said no, and he just left it at that. So rather than focusing his attention on this really key piece of evidence that he needed to create some doubt around, what he did is that he conducted this examination that was very friendly. So I think that, you know, there's a problem here, is that this representation of Mr. Nelson hindered his representation of Ms. Nelson, because it seems that he was afraid of being too hard on Mr. Nelson, because otherwise this relationship with him may come out and the jury would have questions about, well, why is Ms. Nelson representing or being represented by this attorney who's kind of unethical to the extent that he's also representing a prosecution witness? And then why is this attorney trying to retrieve what could be the murder weapon out of police custody before it could be tested? So to avoid this coming out, his cross-examination was hindered. So the allegations in the petition for post-conviction relief, you know, clearly established that there was a relationship, attorney-client relationship, that the PD had undertaken to serve Mr. Nelson in the retrieval of his weapons from police custody, and that his representation of Ms. Nelson was adversely affected by that relationship that he had with Mr. Nelson. So we've clearly established that there is a conflict of interest, and this case should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Noble. You have about 3.5 minutes.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Will Kozlowski, registration number 37824, on behalf of the people. I'll limit my remarks to the conflict of interest claim, since that's what my opponent discussed. I take it in reverse order. He says that her attorney's performance was adversely affected because he failed to cross-examine Ken Nelson and made him come across as a friendly witness. Ken Nelson was probably the friendliest witness to the defense, because if he were believed, then the prosecution's main theory that his duty weapon was the murder weapon was completely removed from the equation, because Ken Nelson testified that he had it with him the whole time. So it's unclear to me why the defense attorney should cross-examine someone and paint him as a liar when the theory of defense is that he's telling the truth. And also in that regard, he has to show that the conflict of interest adversely affected his performance. At no point, even assuming there's an attorney-client relationship or that he undertook something for Mr. Nelson, he has to identify a divided loyalty, which I don't think he has, and he has to identify how that divided loyalty affected his performance at trial. Here he's saying, oh, he represented it, therefore he had a conflict of interest, therefore it adversely affected, without identifying anything in that stream that would adversely affect her attorney's performance.
So, counsel, assuming that there was a conflict, we're supposed to ignore the conflict just because, you know, his counsel otherwise perform well?
No, not at all. You're not supposed to. But Ms. Nelson must allege facts that, if true, would establish a conflict of interest claim. First, he says there's an attorney-client relationship, okay. Then he has to identify a divided loyalty, but he has not done that. There's nothing that, oh, he learned something from his client, from Mr. Nelson, that didn't allow him to cross-examine him well enough, or that he kept back because he thought he was, he thought that he couldn't ask a question because he had previously represented this person. There's no allegations of that. It's just, oh, he was, Mr. Strobel was Mr. Nelson's lawyer, therefore there was a conflict. You have to link the two. You have to say, I mean, the prime example is you previously represented a prosecution witness. And even that is just a potential conflict. There has to be information of this person in his previous case, he probably told him things, and therefore he can't divulge those important things on cross-examination, and he can't have divided loyalties. Here it's just, I mean, the extent of it is, could you help me get my gun back? There's no, oh, he learned that that the gun was involved. There's no allegations to that effect. And I'd also like to comment, at this point in the proceedings, I think the email was sent a week after the shooting. And at this point, I don't think anyone had any notion that this gun was involved or possibly involved. The testimony was that when he heard that his wife was a possible murder suspect, he got in the car with his partner, handed the gun to him, and then she was arrested and he went to his house. And when he got back to the police department, they took his gun away from him because they were afraid he was going to harm himself. And they didn't think it was evidence in the shooting. It was just that for his safety. And so in that regard, it was, can you help me get it back? Because I'm a policeman and I need it for my job. And that under exhibit, it was exhibit 109, which was the telephone conversation that happened before the email. I believe it was before the email that the defendant also said, yeah, I'll tell my lawyer to see if he can get your weapon back. So I think that demonstrates that even if there is some sort of, even on this issue, even if there is some sort of attorney-client relationship, that the defendant wanted him to do the same thing. So there was no conflict or divided loyalty on this issue, and it had no effect on his performance, and he hasn't alleged how it affected his performance.
Mr. Kozlowski, to turn into a slightly different direction and ask you some questions about Ardolino.
Oh, sure.
I know you ended your brief with a quote from Ardolino, which seemed to me to go more to the prejudice prong of the Strickland analysis.
Right.
But if we're looking at the deficient performance prong, how do we make a ruling on the deficient performance without an evidentiary hearing in which they determine that it was actually subjective strategy or not?
Well, do you have a particular claim in mind?
I'm just kind of trying to figure out how Ardolino works in a general way.
Well, I think the general Ardolino stands for the proposition of, well, let me go back. I think under the recent Supreme Court cases in, I don't know if it's Cullen or Pinholster and
United States Supreme Court.
Yeah, United States Supreme Court cases, sorry. That they've generally stated that, or the court has generally stated that the subjective reasoning of the attorney is not necessary or determinative. In both of those cases, initial post-conviction proceeding, the defendant made his allegations, and I think they were failure to investigate and present expert testimony claims to that, something like that. And the California Supreme Court just said denied with no opinion. And then it came up on habeas, and the Ninth Circuit said, well, there's all these reasons, the state has proffered all these reasons of why the attorney could have done this, but we're not going to consider those because you can't make excuses after the fact. And the Supreme Court reversed and said, no, Strickland commands that reviewing courts affirmatively entertain possible explanations. So the proper analysis is if you can come up on the existing record, if you can explain something as reasonable strategy. Well, first of all, it's presumed it's reasonable strategy. And I would say in this case, his allegations don't even refute that presumption, but even assuming they do, if you can come up with a reasonable strategy that could have happened, then that is enough to deny the claim without a hearing. And so Ardolino, Ardolino is a little different in the sense of that attorney did some strange, I would say strange things, essentially bringing out a favorable opinion or a favorable opinion from the prosecutor, from an expert, prosecution expert, and failing to cross-examine the victim with any inconsistent statements that she made. And I think I have the quote. Ardolino says that if there's seemingly unusual, if there's a seemingly unusual or misguided act, then a hearing is warranted. And I think in that situation, it was, these things seem out of the ordinary and on their face, maybe, on, I would guess on their face are ineffective assistance, that we're gonna remand for a hearing and see if there isn't a reasonable explanation as to why he did it, because on this record, we can't come up with one. Does that answer your question? That was kind of roundabout.
No, that answers it, thank you.
Okay. And going back to the conflict of interest claim, I guess not every act a lawyer does on behalf of someone makes him the lawyer's client. And I think this is probably a pretty common occurrence that a family member gets arrested and evidence is seized and you say, hey, can I get this back? And the public defender says, prosecution, can we get this evidence back? Because as I said, at this point, no one had any notion that this gun was possibly involved. And there was no adverse effect because one of the only ineffective things the public defender could have done was paint Mr. Nelson as a liar. That would have been severely detrimental to her case. If there are no other questions, we ask that you affirm the order denying post-conviction relief. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
The prosecution had two theories about the gun that was used in this case. The first theory that they had was that Ms. Nelson used Mr. Nelson's service weapon and she switched it in the morning before he went to work, and then when she was stopped in the pickup truck, that somehow it was switched again, so that they never knew that she actually had that weapon and thought that he had the weapon all along. And then the other theory that they had was that Ms. Nelson used her Glock 27, and what she did was throw two shell casings on the ground to kind of implicate Mr. Nelson or to confuse the investigation. So they didn't have a consistent theory on what weapon was used in the murder. And this was a big problem for them because both the theories that they had were kind of convoluted theories that would be difficult for a jury to understand. That, for instance, that a police officer, you know, would switch the gun when his wife is being arrested, and that somehow he wouldn't realize that his gun had been switched during the day, or that she used this Glock 27 and then threw shell casings on the ground. The problem with that theory is that the Glock 27 is also a semi-automatic weapon, and it ejects shell casings. So the only way that she could leave the scene without the shell casings from that gun being left at the scene would be to have some kind of bag on the gun that would collect the shell casings, so that she could then throw the other shell casings on the floor to thwart the investigation. So the prosecution had problems with which weapon was used in the killing. So defense counsel didn't need to, you know, be that friendly with Mr. Nelson during cross-examination to establish this issue about the weapon. The bigger concern that defense counsel had was the mask. Mr. Nelson testified that he hadn't recognized that. He'd never seen that mask before, whereas Ms. Nelson was saying that that was a mask that they had at a prior Halloween, and she'd left it in his truck. So that was where he really needed to focus his cross-examination. So when we're establishing a conflict of interest, all we have to do to establish that there's the conflict had an adverse effect is point to something different that defense counsel would have done rather than what he did do, which was based on his relationship with Mr. Nelson. And this is what explains the adverse effect here, is that he didn't do any impeachment of Mr. Nelson other than ask him about the pending charges in the plea agreement. That was pretty much the extent of it. When it came to the mass, he just asked an open-ended question and accepted the answer. Didn't do any serious impeachment around Mr. Nelson's denial that that mask had been in the truck previously. So the allegations in the petition established that there was a conflict of interest, there was this attorney-client relationship, and also that that adversely affected defense counsel's performance at trial. So it asked the court to vacate the order denying post-conviction relief and remand this for an evidentiary hearing.
Thank you very much to both counsel for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.